Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. So when someone tells me that they found their soulmate, what does that mean? When I hear it, unless it's better explained to me, I might think that my friend believes that he has found one person in the world who completes him, who might actually believe that this mate is the second half of an otherwise incomplete soul. Now, I might be concerned that he would have unrealistic expectations as to his future happiness with his new love. Recently, I read an article in the Grand Rapids Press that was originally published at theconversation.com on soulmates, and I thought it would make a great conversation here. So we have found, and this author of What's Behind the Belief in a Soulmate is here. His name is Dr. Brad Onishi, and a little bit about the professor. He holds degrees from Azusa Pacific University, Oxford, and the University of California at Santa Barbara. He normally teaches at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. Currently, he's on sabbatical. And some of the courses that he has taught include God, Sex, and Love in the History of Christianity, Religious Approaches to Death and Dying, Reenchantment and the Secular, Religion and Politics in Contemporary American Society, Atheism, and Comparative Mysticism. His research is focused on two distinct but related areas. In the first instance, he explores the resonances between the Christian mystical traditions and contemporary philosophy. This has resulted in two volumes, Christian Mysticism, An Introduction to Contemporary Theoretical Approaches, and Mysticism in the French Tradition, that bring medieval mystics in conversation with modern philosophers. So we welcome to Common Threads Dr. Bradley Onishi. Hello, Brad.
Hello, thanks for having me, Fred.
Certainly. So in your article, the first thing you talk about is this romantic slump that we're in, talking about American society. I'm assuming we're limiting it, at least at the moment, to American society. And that includes less weddings. And that's not surprising, because we've been going down this road for a long time, where fewer people are getting married. But when you look at society, it doesn't surprise me that less people are getting married. But what does surprise me is that in this age of Tinder and other dating sites and apps and everything else that makes up American society, we're having less sex. That kind of surprises me. And I'm wondering if you can make sense of that for us.
Yeah, I think that surprises a lot of people. And, you know, there's been a recent kind of set of articles on the romantic and sexual slump that we're in as a country. And one of those was in the Atlantic, and there's several others. And it is surprising, because seemingly we live in an age of limitless romantic and sexual possibilities. I mean, you have an app on your phone, you can sort of scroll through potential, you know, partners, people you want to go on a date with, whatever it may be. They're close by, so you go meet up. This seems very convenient, much different than generations ago. What's actually happening is, you know, many young people are quote unquote dating a lot, which means they're on their phones, they're texting or talking via app with one or several or many people on a kind of daily or weekly basis. And yet their sort of face-to-face interactions are oftentimes very rare. And so they might be dating, quote unquote, quite a bit, meaning they're talking to potential romantic or sexual partners, but their actual, you know, face-to-face or physical interaction with them might be very limited. And that translates into the fact that people are having less sex, and that goes beyond young people. There seems to be a kind of sexual slump across the generations. And I think it is one of the unexpected outcomes of the digital age that, because we are able to use our devices so often, in fact, sort of human-to-human encounters have become less frequent.
Has anybody told them that this sex stuff actually feels good? I don't know.
I'm sure that has happened. And I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is more that, one of the ways to think about it is a paralysis of choice. There's so many possibilities to meet people that it's hard to sort of focus one's attention on just one person or a kind of long-term thing. And I think the other is just we're finding that, fewer and fewer people are actually meeting face-to-face in any sort of situation. I mean, people are ordering all of their things online. Brick-and-mortar shops are closing up. We're getting used to our relationships being digital. And so that is being transferred into the romantic realm as well.
Yeah, that is amazing. Again, it, as I said a couple of minutes ago, I can understand the decline in marriage. It's hard for me to put myself, because I'm an old guy, and so it's hard for me to put myself in the brain of a 19, 20-year-old male, let alone a 19, 20-year-old female, and think, okay, this is living. Oh wow, I'm texting with three different women. Oh my God, I'm a playboy. So getting into the subject specifically of your article, Soulmate, you mentioned that more people believe in soulmates than God, but I think we really need the best definition of soulmate we can get. And I realize there could be several. I think people might just offhandedly say, I found my soulmate, meaning I found a really nice person that I enjoy and we're going to get married or we're going to have a relationship, as opposed to something that might be deeper, such as I found the one person created in the universe specifically for me. And this is a God-ordained thing and it could never, ever happen with anybody else. Am I right that there's a lot of wiggle room in that definition?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of comments worth making here. One is, we would expect in the digital age that the idea of the one, the romantic one, the romantic soulmate would go away. Well, who can believe in that when at your fingertips on your phone, you have thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of potential people you could meet? I mean, how could it ever be that there'd be one person? And what we're actually finding is that plethora, that overabundance of choice is really difficult. It's dizzying. It's hard to figure out who is a potential long-term partner and who's just a fling. And there's so many possibilities and so many just sort of like an overwhelming amount of information and people that, in fact, the one is making a comeback. Right. The idea that there's a soulmate out there is very comforting. That the idea that there's somebody out there that I'm destined for and that who might complete me is incredibly, incredibly comforting in an age where there seems to be no certainty, right? And nothing given. The idea of the soulmate that I'm using comes from a 2017 Monmouth poll. And it kind of boils down to this, right? Two-thirds of Americans believe in the concept of a soulmate, which is a person out there who is destined to be with them. And so, again, you might say, well, how can destiny exist in the age of Tinder? Well, my response is destiny, the belief in destiny exists because people are looking for a story, a myth of love that they can fall back on that will give them some hope in a time when it just seems like really, really, really difficult to meet the right person.
And you say that more people believe, well, not you, but the research shows that more people believe in the concept of a soulmate than they do in God. And the question that comes to mind is, then if there is this cosmic destiny, wouldn't a deity sort of be in charge of that? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So what I'm claiming is, we have about two-thirds of Americans in 2017 who believe in soulmates. The number of people in this country who believe in the biblical God is less. It's in sort of the 60 percentile. And so we have this strange situation where more people believe in the romantic one than in the divine one. And as you just said, well, how can that be? Because I just explained the idea of a romantic soulmate as destiny. One of the claims I'd like to make is that the idea of the romantic one and the idea of the divine one are intimately linked. That, you know, there are many folks out there who claim to be non-religious or atheist or agnostic and sort of think that belief, especially in a monotheistic God, might be kind of outdated or unrealistic, who are totally into the newest rom-com that just came out, watching The Bachelor, and otherwise just sort of indulging in the kind of ubiquitous myth of the soulmate that we have in our culture, right? And so I think you're right to say that there seems to be something sort of divine or supernatural when one talks about a soulmate. And yet what I'm trying to say is that there are many folks out there who admittedly believe in a romantic one and yet don't somehow sort of make the connection that that would be some kind of spiritual or religious belief, that it would be a kind of myth on par with something like a religious or spiritual myth that other people hold.
But now you just said a couple of seconds ago something that I did not read in the article. When talking about the number of people who believe in God, you clarified the biblical God. And I can name a number of people in my life who would say, no, I would not believe in God as God is defined in the Judeo-Christian Bible, but I do believe in an absolute transcendence, or we can quibble about the language, but something like that.
Yeah. So I think just to be clear, in the article I use research from the Pew Research Forum, and they talk about the fact that, you know, most Americans do believe in some kind of higher power, right? It's a very, very high percentage of Americans who believe in some sort of higher, deity or authority or spirit or something else. It's many fewer who believe in that deity as he or she or it is described in the Bible. And so when I make the claim that more of us believe in the romantic one than the divine one, what I'm claiming is that in this country, we have more folks who now believe in the romantic soulmate than in the God who is described in the Bible.
Understand. Thank you. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and we're speaking with Dr. Brad Onishi, and the subject of today is soulmates. You talk about the first time we read or hear the concept soulmate. It comes from Samuel Coleridge and his use of the word, and how he basically said, if you want a happy marriage, you have to find a soulmate. But we're talking about 19th century America, and the whole tradition, the whole ethos of marriage was quite a bit different back then. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the important parts of Coleridge's, use of soulmate. I mean, to my knowledge, Samuel Taylor Coleridge is the first one to use the word soulmate in 1822. And he says that to be happy to marry life, you must have a soulmate. Well, that's significant for a number of reasons. One of which is the fact that it really highlights that love and marriage have rarely gone together in the history of the human species. That marriage has more often than not been an institution based on economic or social or political status, and love has been something different altogether. What we see in Coleridge is the sort of beginnings of the development of the love marriage, right? That marriage is about love. This will sort of fully bloom more than a century later in the kind of mid-20th century during the sexual revolution and the sort of last half of the 20th century, especially in the United States. But Coleridge's comment here really sort of helps us keep in mind that love and marriage have not always been together. And in fact, it's been very rare that they've gone together.
And would you say that this is one of the reasons why in society back then, the idea of for instance, men having mistresses or wives having lovers on the side, if everything was done discreetly, there was sort of a nod and a wink given, not in every occasion, but certainly in many occasions. It was this because the marriage was not founded on love, and both people knew that.
I think so. You know, if we look back in history, you know, we find way before Coleridge, we find, and you know, many listeners will be familiar with this, we find in Plato's Symposium a speech by the comic poet Aristophanes, and Aristophanes says that before time, humans were all united together. Zeus, out of jealousy and arrogance, sort of split them apart, and so all of us are now walking around Earth, sort of half of a soul, in search of our lost mate, our lost soulmate. And that comes in the context of a situation where, yeah, marriage was not about love. And so when Aristophanes talks about searching for a soulmate, it's very clearly searching for that one person, right, for whom you're destined, the one who will complete you, the one who will make you yourself. And there's really no explicit reference to that being your spouse, your married partner. That leads us forward, and we can fast forward a kind of 1,000 years to, you know, the era of Arthurian romance and troubadours in France. And we see there the same thing, right? That, you know, those in the upper crust aristocratic parts of society would be married for status, for economic or political gain. And yet they often played these elaborate games and participated in these elaborate courting rituals, right? This is where we get the word courting. These courting rituals that were all the kind of things you were talking about. They would involve a wink and a nod and, you know, very sly ways of expressing affection and desire. And it was really understood that if one wanted to experience love and true passion, it would happen outside of marriage. And so, again, this idea that love and marriage go together is quite a new concept.
And can you tell us how it, at least in European society, how the church responded to this wink and a nod society, where quote unquote true love was found beyond the bounds of monogamous marriage?
Yeah, I mean, if we look to the medieval society I just mentioned, right? If we talk about medieval Europe, the 11th or 12th or 13th centuries, what we see there are kind of two rival approaches to love. The church, right, meaning at this point, pre-Reformation, the Catholic Church, has an idea of love that is based on the divine one, on God. Love comes from God. It's ordered, you know, sort of downward in the hierarchy of creation through God's, you know, God's love and ordinance. And so all love must be ordered according to God's plan. I mean, this is sort of very familiar in Christian terms, I'm sure to many of your listeners. And yet what you have in courtly love, in this love that I just described, is a human rival to the divine story. You have a human version of love that says that human love is intrinsically good, that if I am destined for one person with whom I can experience true identity and true passion, that that is intrinsically good in itself, that that actually may be the goal of life itself. Well, in that model, that rival model to the sort of, you know, dominant Catholic vision, we see the very sort of early elements of what we now take to be standard, the idea that marriage is about love, that life is about, you know, for many people, not all, but life is about finding fulfillment in a kind of, you know, long-term, if not lifelong, partnership with someone you feel very sort of close to and with whom you have a unique relationship.
And you bring up in the article the biblical Song of Songs, or Solomon's Song, often also called the Canticle of Canticles, depending on which Bible you decide to open up. And there we have this rather passionate dialogue going on. And I know that in Catholicism, that story is supposed to be symbolic of Christ's love for his church. But you're saying that the other point of view is just take it as it is, right? This is celebrating human love. We don't have to use it as a metaphor. Am I reading that right?
Well, I think it's a really complex. I think that's a really complex story. So, what you know, here's kind of how I came to all of this. You know, about 10 years ago, I had a bad breakup, right? Just to be honest, and I kind of started to think, you know, here I am, I'm undergoing this sort of personal, like, you know, sadness, and I'm like in my room reflecting on all of it, writing bad poetry, the whole thing, things you do after a bad breakup, drinking whiskey. And I'm wondering, how did this idea of the soulmate even come about? Like, if I've just sort of lost my soulmate, you know, why do I even think about that? So I started thinking, well, where did we get this idea? And, you know, you start digging into it and you get the standard responses. You find the quote from Samuel Taylor Coleridge, you look into Plato's Symposium, you know, you watch the romantic comedies, you read some Shakespeare. However, I'm a scholar of religion, and it dawned on me that it seems like the first iteration of the soulmate comes in the relationship between Yahweh and his people Israel. If we think about a soulmate as someone who completes you, who makes you yourself for the first time, who says, hey, you know, all of those other lovers and partners you've had in the past, you need to forget them, because all that matters is the fact that our relationship is consummating your true destiny. Well, that sounds very much like what Yahweh, right, the monotheistic God, says to the people of Israel when he forms them, right, throughout the Hebrew Bible. And so I started thinking, like, I actually think that Yahweh was the first soulmate and Israel was his partner. Well, that actually bears out when you start reading the Hebrew Bible in its expansiveness. So the Song of Songs is an erotic love poem. You know, it's that book in the Bible that kids in Sunday school or other places sort of, you know, open up and giggle, because it's kind of unexpected. This is an erotic love poem right in the middle of Scripture. Well, you know, Hebrew scholars, rabbis, others over history have interpreted the Song of Songs as an illustration of the relationship between Israel and Yahweh. That is to say that this passionate erotic affair between a female narrator, in this case Israel, and her male lover slash groom, Yahweh, is illustrative of the relationship between God and his people. That marital metaphor is, of course, used in other places. If you look at the book of Ezekiel or the book of Hosea, it's very clear, right, that Yahweh is the husband, Israel is the wife, and they have this kind of very passionate and at times tempestuous, you know, sort of love affair. Well, that kind of clued me in to the idea that maybe this idea of soulmates goes further back than we thought, and maybe it has religious sources rather than just philosophical or literary sources.
So what you're saying is, if I'm reading you correctly, you can use this allegorical passionate love affair to inform you of the divine, and possibly use a real human love affair to help explain divinity.
I think that's right, and I think that's kind of what, you know, when we do the research, that's kind of what we see has happened in many cases in, you know, the Jewish tradition in terms of the interpretation of the Hebrew Bible and the Song of Songs or other places. You know, one of the things that I tell my students in my God, Sex, Love course is there's a case to be made that over the course of the first 1,000 years of Christianity, that the Song of Songs is the most important book of the Bible for Christian theologians and mystics, because beginning in the 3rd century with Origen of Alexandria and going forward from there, there's a long and expansive tradition of mystics and theologians who see in this erotic relationship described in the Song of Songs the very best, the most poignant example of how the soul relates to Christ. For them, the sort of passionate dissolving into one another that one finds in the Song of Songs and one often experiences in erotic sort of encounters, right, is most illustrative of what happens between the soul and Christ. And so, strangely enough, we find a kind of erotic logic at the very heart of early and medieval Christian theology, just in the place where you would maybe never expected, or for at least most of my students, they would have never thought to find it.
At that point in the church, was genuine physical sexual expression really focused on procreation only, or were they bringing the more human romantic element into it as well?
Well, and this is one of the very tricky parts of this, is that, you know, for the people I'm talking about, for the theologians and mystics who would have been writing books about the Song of Songs, these, in almost every case, are people who are celibate. These are people who are committed to a life without physical erotic encounter. And so, you know, what's, again, this is sort of very interesting, is that we have those who have sworn off a sexual life on earth proclaiming that the best way to understand their relationship with divine is through an erotic set of images, right? So it's a very sort of interesting kind of phenomenon. And my students, you know, oftentimes kind of have a hard time getting their head around this. Like, why would the people who have sworn off sex make their whole spiritual life about sex? And there's a couple of answers. I mean, an easy answer is that it's all sort of repression and sublimation, right? You're not allowed to have sex on earth, so you sort of become obsessed with sex in terms of, you know, spiritual life and a kind of way of reading it, you know, privately or something. I think it's just more complex than that, right? I think that there's more going on. And I guess for me, going back to the original point, one of the things that's happening is these celibate monks and theologians and mystics are making Christ their soulmate. They're saying, on earth, I will have no other one who completes me and who is my destiny. I am looking to Christ as the one who completes me, who makes me myself, who will make me happy, and who will sort of consummate my life in all of eternity. I think that's really interesting for a number of reasons, one of which is just simply the fact that many of these folks really made Jesus into their divine and romantic ones.
And let me stop you right there, Brad, because we are out of time this week, but this is a fascinating conversation. Let's have you back next week, and we'll continue this.
Sounds great. I would love that.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today has been Dr. Bradley Onishi from Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. We're talking about soulmates, and we will do the same next week, so please do tune in right here on Common Threads. This is WGVU.